Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is Thursday, January 28, 2016. I'm Senator Mia Costello, and with me today I have Vice Chair Senator Giesel. Welcome. Senate President Kevin Meyer, welcome, and Senator Johnny Ellis, welcome. And I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Carrie, and the LIO operator, Ben, for your assistance during this meeting. The time, by the way, is 1:34. So today we have four bills on the agenda. We have Senate Bill 121, which we heard at our last committee, and the intent is to move that bill out of committee today. That is the security freeze on minors' credit report. Next, we will hear House Bill 12, which is the mortgage lending and loan originators bill. The intention is to have the first hearing and then to answer questions, take public testimony, and hold that. Next, we will have House Bill 155, which is a fees, waivers, credits, deductions, and taxes bill. Again, we'll have the first hearing on that bill, hear testimony on it, take questions, and hold it. And then finally, we will hear Senate Bill 111, which is a limit flame retardant on furniture bill that will have its first hearing. We will hear from the sponsor, take testimony, and then hold that bill. All the bills in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee have had, at the minimum, two hearings. So I just wanted to mention that we thoroughly review our bills. So with that, I want to welcome the sponsor staff and Edra Morledge to answer any questions that the committee members had made at the last meeting. And then if there are additional questions for the sponsor or your staff, we'll take those at that time. So welcome, Edra. If you could introduce yourself for the committee.
My name is Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer.
And the sponsor has provided answers to the questions that were asked at the last hearing. Would you like to briefly go over those? And we'll see if there's additional questions.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Costello and members of the committee. As you know, I provided a packet with some supplemental information based on the questions that were asked in the committee on Tuesday. Senator Stevens had asked if there would be an easier way to word the terminology on lines 9 and 10, which references another statute. We can certainly inquire with the drafters to see if that's a possibility. I do know that that wording is taken directly from the title of the section that it's referencing, but we're open to doing that if the committee wishes. Secondly, Senator Ellis had asked a couple of questions, the first of which was where the idea of the legislation had come from, and so I included in your packets an email from Senator Meyer's constituent who brought the idea forward to our office. And secondly, he asked if Alaska would be the fifth state, and that was based on statements that I made. And so I provided information from NCSL, the National Council of State Governments, that backs up where I derived those figures from as far as what each state is doing. Next, let's see, Senator Stevens inquired as to the process for lifting a credit freeze, and so I included in your supplemental packet the Alaska Personal Information Protection Act, which details the process which a individual can go through to lift a credit freeze. And our other statutes reference that a consumer can do that, and consumer is defined as an individual with a credit report or a credit score. So seemingly once someone has a freeze put on their credit file, they can, when they reach an age of needing to establish credit, lift that freeze themselves. And lastly, Chair Costello, you asked what the national average is for child identity theft, and finding statistics is proving to be a little bit elusive because it's such a new breakout of the traditional reporting for just identity theft in general. So there are varying statistics on that, but they generally range between 10 and 11%. And finally, there were some questions from Senator Giesel about some prior inquiries to Department of Law about whether this type of legislation was possible. And so I included in your packet communications I had with Department of Law that indicated that they do not have an issue with the way that the bill is worded now.
Senator Meyer, any other questions for the senator or the staff?
Okay.
Senator Meyer, do you wish to make any comments on your bill?
No, I think it's, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a good bill, and I'm glad our constituent brought it to our attention. I believe my staff, Edra, has pretty much summarized the bill.
Senator Giesel?
Are you ready for a motion,
yes,
Madam Chair? Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 121, version 29LS1129/alpha from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Okay, seeing no objection, so moved. And we will take a brief at ease as we sign the documents. Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. Next on our agenda, we have House Bill 12, which is introduced by, is it the House Labor and Commerce Committee? Oh, Representative Hughes, your bill. So welcome to the committee. If you would like to introduce yourself and your staff and present your bill for us today.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Shelley Hughes, State House Representative, District 11, Palmer, and with me is my staffer, Ginger Blaisdell. Thank you for hearing HB 12, mortgage lending. Often we consider legislation, particularly in a Labor and Commerce Committee, that does four things. One, it levels the playing field. Two, it might streamline the process either for a private entity or for the state of Alaska. Three, it might, particularly in this committee, involve consumer protection issues. And four, it might update something due to a new phenomenon, perhaps an emerging technology or perhaps a federal law change. Well, with HB 12, it's all four of those things. I'm going to start with a level playing field. Under current statutes, an employee mortgage loan originator, which I will call an MLO, an employee MLO working for a bank, has to have an MLO license, but not a mortgage lender broker license. But the bank under which that person, employee, works is under federal regulations. Now, a contract MLO, as opposed to an employee MLO, currently also works under a bank, but has to have both an MLO license and a mortgage lender broker license. And that's where you don't have the current level playing field. So they have to get two licenses. So what this does is create a more level playing field so that the those that are contract MLOs only have to get the one license. So it eliminates an unnecessarily licensure layer. The second thing, streamlining the process, which is good on both sides. It's good for the state of Alaska and for the industry, because now what the requirement is that the bank would be registered under the state, so the state would then have a more efficient oversight auditing just the bank rather than all these individual MLO contractors scattered through the state. So it's a streamlined process and helpful, a win-win on both sides. And then thirdly, this in turn better protects the public, because when oversight is appropriate, the consumer is better protected. And then as far as that change, a new phenomena, there was a federal legislation passed in 2008, And so there is a part of the bill that would exempt certain government agencies from the state licensure because they're already having to comply with the SAFE Act at the federal level. And so that's already met. So again, this bill does four things. It levels the playing field, it streamlines the oversight process, it protects the consumer, and it accounts for the new phenomena, which is the change in federal law. So, and when I think about it, especially when we're facing fiscal challenges here at the state time, I believe it's our responsibility to improve however we can the statutes to accommodate businesses in these types of ways so we can have as healthy of an economic climate as possible in Alaska. So Ginger is able to get into any of the specifics of the bill and go through it as you wish, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is it the will of the committee to go through the sectional? Okay. Ms. Blaisdell, could you please walk us through a sectional for this bill?
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell. I'm staff to Representative Hughes. And HB 12 in Section 1, I can kind of go through this very quickly. Most of the changes in the bill are changing terminology. So you're going to see an awful lot of the same language change that's calling it a registered depository institution. That's our bank. And so we are basically upgrading the terminology throughout the whole bill. Same words are replacing that. And what that is that is State Farm Bank that is not located physically in the state of Alaska, but they are now registered with the state of Alaska. And so that's the majority of what these section changes are doing. Let me make sure I have the right version here. So again, you're going to see in Section 1, Registered Depository Institution, and the exclusive contract for a registered depository institution, and this is the section that's going to identify that the contract agent who owns their own business and is initiating mortgage loans, they are not going to be supervising themselves. So now the bank will supervise that person. Section 2 is a new section that outlines the requirements for a depository institution to be eligible to sponsor a mortgage loan originator. What this does is it says the bank is going to assume all of the supervisory responsibilities for that contractor, similar to an employer-employee relationship. So Section 3 exempts federal, state, or local government agencies, and this is what makes them compliant with the SAFE Act. Right now, the two that are going to be affected by this is AHFC, that offers HUD loans, and Anchorage HUD program. And I think you'll see we removed one section where we were going to exempt nonprofits. And we heard some outcry from some industry members where some nonprofits are venturing further than just serving particular population groups that might be more needy. And so we removed that because they are getting more into a competitive marketplace and maybe they do need that kind of oversight. So that's why the nonprofit section was removed.
Blaisdell, your fiscal note, I think, references an earlier version then because it mentions in it that it does exempt nonprofits. So even though this is not the Finance Committee, I just recommend that as this moves along, that it's just something I wanted to note.
Yeah, I didn't see an updated fiscal note for this. Okay, yeah, normally they are updated. Okay, thank you. Section 4, depository institutions, so we're adding that registered depository institution, we're adding that bank into the language along with other banks. So they are now going to hold the bond for all of their agents. They are, if they are in more than one location, they carry that bond for each location. It has to last for 3 years, and the department can determine if that bond is unsatisfactory. So same as a bank.
They have to, in Section 8, they have to follow the requirements of an annual report, so they do have to do all the same reporting requirements that are required of other mortgage lenders. And then Sections 9 through 13 are adding registered depository institution in the requirements for managing mortgage records. So that's all of the accounting and paperwork requirements. Section 14 is referencing the availability of out-of-state records. So if the bank is located out of the state of Alaska, our Division of Banking and Securities can go to that other state and conduct an audit or a review. The state can do investigations within the state, so if there's a question about it, maybe a particular contractor, they can go to that place of business and review the work. A new subsection, so Section 16 defines a person, and so under this title, the person is the contractor. And so it's also going to include that that person is working for the registered depository institution. Section 17 allows the department to have corrective action if they find a problem. So it could be censure, suspension, they could remove the license. They have a number of things that they can act on. Number 18, Section 18 is applicability of administrative procedures, and so they can do an administrative hearing, and that's just their matter, their regular course of business for the department. New definition, a registered depository institution. So that is, again, that's a bank that is located outside of the state of Alaska, registering as the supervisor of these independent contractors. And effective date, oh, you know what, I don't know, I didn't check the effective date on this bill. It may have started 3 weeks ago, we don't know it. we'll probably have to correct that to 2017, so we will do that.
Okay. Are there any questions of committee members? Senator Giesel.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Blaisdell, you mentioned on page 1, line 11 and 12, a registered depository institution is a bank, and then you reference State Farm. Are they the only entity that this would affect, or are there other entities in the state that will be impacted by this bill?
Senator Giesel, through the chair. At this point in time, State Farm Bank and its contractors are the primary business that it would be impacted by this. There have been other similar business models that have chosen not to continue on with banking and mortgage lending. I think Allstate was one of those that has chosen not to. So at this point, it is specifically one business that we know of that would be impacted by this, not to say that there aren't others out there.
Thank you. Could I ask a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Absolutely.
So another question I had may pertain to the fiscal note, actually, but I'll let you opine on it. So as I understand this, the individual agents working under State Farm Bank's umbrella were in a position where they were had to be individually audited by the Division of Banking, if that's a division. Anyway, will this now, and so now with this bill, only State Farm Bank itself would be audited. So it would reduce, it sounds like, the workload for banking. Do you expect it to be a positive fiscal effect? Do you have any sense of the fiscal impact?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I think there are two things. First, the fiscal note is a zero fiscal note, and so I don't think that the Division of Banking and Securities felt that there were going to be additional costs with this piece of legislation if it were to pass. The efficiencies that I think the state will be able to see are in two different ways. One of them is that right now there are 19 individual businesses
the contractors of the State Farm Bank that are being audited on an individual basis. So that's 19 audits that are done by the Division of Banking and Securities. If this bill were to pass, State Farm Bank as one entity would be audited and they would look at all 19 at the same time. The other efficiency is that because there are 19 businesses to be audited individually, not all of them are audited maybe as frequently as they could be. And so under this circumstance, they would all be seen at the same time, and rather than one at a time, and maybe none of them during certain years.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from committee members? Okay. We have either Kevin Anthem from the Division of Banking Securities or Tracy Reno is online. Kevin or Tracy, are you there?
Yes, we are. This is Kevin Anselm with the Division of Banking and Securities, and I do have several members of the mortgage lending staff with me.
Thank you for being available, Ms. Anselm. So does the administration have a position on this bill?
No, we are neutral on the bill. Thank you.
And did you want to provide any comments, perhaps comment on the potential efficiencies or any of the questions that came up from Senator Giesel?
We do believe that it would be a zero fiscal impact to the division because, of course, a larger examination will take longer when we'll do one individual examination of the employing depository as opposed to individual agents.
Are there any consumer protection issues, either, you know, positive or perhaps negative, that you want to comment on related to this bill?
This is Tracy Reno. I would just add that we would be able to discuss issues, whether they're enforcement or supervisory, with State Farm Bank rather than individuals. State Farm Bank currently does the majority of their reporting and their supervisory stuff now. Unfortunately, we don't have access to them because we deal with the individual agents at this point.
Okay, thank you. And Tracy is the financial a financial examiner for the Division of Banking and Securities, in case you're wondering. So, hey. Okay, with that, I think I will go ahead and open public testimony for House Bill 12. Is there anyone online who would like to testify? I think I've got Chrissy Babcock. Are you online?
Yes.
Oh, she's here. Welcome, Chrissy. Absolutely.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chrissy Babcock. I'm an independent contractor, State Farm agent in Kenai. I thank you for scheduling House Bill 12 and the opportunity to express my support for House Bill 12. I've been an agent and small business owner in Kenai for the past 16 years. I employ 8 individuals in my office. I market insurance and bank products on behalf of State Farm, exclusively to Alaskans and also on behalf of State Farm Bank. As part of my business, I originate home loan applications exclusively for State Farm Bank. An originator, an MLO, is one who basically processes the initial application. Banks and their employee agents are exempt from state licensing requirements because they are federally regulated. But because I'm an independent contractor, I am required to be licensed as and follow all of the regulations for mortgage loan originators under state law. The MLO, Mortgage Loan Originator License, requires rigorous state and federal testing, background checks, fingerprinting, and annual continuing education and licensing renewal. I've gone through this process so that I have one more way of providing services to my customers, in particular more lending options to Alaska homeowners, many of whom I have long and trusted relationships. I don't contest the state MLO licensing requirement. HB 12 would not change or reduce that requirement in any way. What HB 12 does address is an additional license I'm currently required to have because of state statute. Under Alaska law, an MLO must be sponsored and supervised by a mortgage broker or a mortgage company. But because banks are exempt from having a state mortgage broker license, I must also be licensed as a mortgage company or a mortgage broker. Ironically, only to supervise and sponsor myself as an MLO. This doesn't make sense because I'm supervising myself and I'm not brokering loans. It's not required in any other situation, and it causes unnecessary expense and is burdensomely time-consuming. The extra cost is approximately $2,000 personally per year, plus dozens of hours of time are required for quarterly reporting, annual reporting, and even more reporting every spring. HB 12 is a win-win solution because it removes the unnecessary cost and burdens on me as an MLO without reducing any protections associated with the broker supervision piece. The fix in HB 12 allows the sponsoring bank, in my case State Farm Bank, to step in and register with the state of Alaska as my supervisor. By registering, the bank assumes all the liabilities, responsibilities, and oversight of a mortgage broker. This makes more sense because it's actually the bank that's the lender while I'm just the originator. It actually provides more oversight to have the bank be my supervisor rather than me supervising myself. Basically, I currently wear two hats. HB 12 doesn't eliminate a hat. It just simply moves that hat to where it should logically be worn by the bank. 26 other states have licensing similar to what would be done by HB 12, and there's legislation in other states that is possible. In closing, I want to emphasize that this bill would not result in any less regulation than for other mortgage loan originators. We would all have the same requirements of the residential lending companies, plus the continuing federal oversight over banks. This legislation was first introduced in 2014 and then again in 2015. I sincerely hope that you'll pass this out of your committee soon so that it may move forward this year. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to be a resource in answering any questions or providing information.
Any questions? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think you answered my question. I didn't know if this problem was unique to Alaska, but it sounds like other states have had a similar problem and have gone through the same process that you're going through.
They have. 5 or 6 years ago, each state, in response to new federal laws, needed to change the way they licensed mortgage loan originators. And each state did it a little bit different. 26 or so decided to do it in the way that this law proposes. There's about 10 or 12 left that have this dual licensing requirement. And so this bill would change it to the way about 26 other states are currently doing it.
Okay, great. And you don't want to supervise yourself anymore?
I think the bank might be a little more strict on you than myself. I am a self-employed person, but for this bill, the bank would be my supervisor.
There you go. Good. Makes sense.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Manager.
Thank you, Christy.
Thank you.
Next, I've got Roger Bainbridge, who's here in Juneau. Welcome. If you could state your name, and looks like you're from Illinois.
Correct. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Roger Bainbridge. I am in-house counsel for State Farm Bank, FSB, and we're headquartered in Bloomington, Illinois. Christy did a fantastic job covering everything, and anything else I would add would be redundant. So I guess I'm here in favor of HB 12 and would seek a due pass recommendation. I'm also available to answer any questions. And actually, if I could take that opportunity, there was a question about whether this pertained only to State Farm Bank. And while our business model may be unique in that this legislation addresses independent contractors who are working exclusively in mortgage origination on behalf of a federally chartered bank, there is certainly nothing that limits the effectiveness just to State Farm Bank. It would be anybody who has that particular business model and would meet the definitions that have been added to this legislation. So it is not just for the bank.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else online who would like to testify on House Bill 12? Anyone? Okay.
One more in Anchorage.
Yes, is this Steve Ashman?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair.
Steve, if that is you, we are not able to hear you.
Yeah, well, I was just walking up to the microphone. Can you hear me now, Madam Chair?
If you'd like to provide your name and your testimony for the committee, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Steve Ashman. I'm a division manager with the Department of Health and Human Services with the Municipality of Anchorage. And my division manages programs, pass-through programs through the federal government, housing and urban development, and we fall under the Federal Safe Act as well as the State Safe Act. I want to point out that for many years, or a couple of years, the federal government was working off of an interim rule of 2009. They finalized that rule in 2011, and in the finalization, they provided some additional clarification on the safe implementation of the SAFE Act. One of the clarifications that they identified was that a municipal organization could be exempt from the registration and licensing requirements of the SAFE Act because of the federal and local, state or local government, in my case local government, oversight of the program, which I can tell you is pretty substantial. Another clarification that they made in the final ruling is that loan originators working for a government agency undertake their activities without the same in financial incentive that the private industry takes. For these reasons, HUD determined that the commercial context isn't involved in the local government or government agencies' implementation or underwriting of mortgage loans. And one of the things they did indicate that is the SAFE Act definition of a loan originator does not encompass government employees, and government employees are not required to obtain state license and registration for any loan origination under a government housing assistance program. I think that the way the bill is written now, the state law will mirror the federal law, and then, as such, the department is in support of the exemption for local government, for government agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Ashman. Are there any questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none. Is there anyone else online who would like to testify on House Bill 12? Okay, seeing none, I will close public testimony, and we will be holding House Bill 12 if there are any further questions that members have, and then it's my understanding that the sponsor will make bring an updated fiscal note to travel with the bill and also make that minor change on the effective date on the last line of the bill. So with that, now I want to welcome Representative Thompson and your staff. We are looking at House Bill 165. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Thompson. I represent the House Representative from House District 2 up in Fairbanks. And with me I have my staff, Brody Anderson. I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair and Senators, for hearing House Bill 155. In the 28th Legislature, legislation was passed that defined indirect expenditures as foregone revenue. The legislation also set forth a requirement that certain reports identify potential loss of foregone revenue by the department. The Legislative Finance Indirect Expenditure Report reviewed Departments of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Fish and Game, Health and Social Services, and Revenue. The report identified certain credits, fees, discounts, and deductions that should be terminated. House Bill 155 repealed some of these expenditures with an estimated increase of revenue of approximately $450,000. And to walk you through the bill, I'll have my staff, Brody Anderson.
Welcome, Brody, if you could introduce yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, legislative aide to Representative Steve Thompson. Like the representative mentioned, HB 155 is the next step in addressing the foregone revenue to the state identified in the 2015 indirect expenditure report. HB 155 will repeal the following indirect expenditures: the small loan company business license exemption, the exploration incentive credit, the tobacco product tax deduction for timely filing, the cigarette tax stamp discount, the motor fuel tax timely filing, the large passenger vessel gambling tax deduction. And so if we were to walk through the bill repeals these exemptions, credits, deductions, and discounts in Section 10 of the bill, and the rest of the sections provide cleanup language to the other portions of statute that reference those statutory appeals. In Section 1 and 2, it removes references to the exploration incentive credit from AS 410910A and B. Section 3 removes references from the exploration incentive credit from AS 4320043G. Section 4 amends 4355210 to disallow the deduction for federal taxes for the purpose of calculating the state tax on large passenger cruise ship gambling activity. Section 5 amends AS 4340-10C by removing language that allowed motor fuel dealers to retain a portion of the motor fuel tax due to cover expenses for filing the motor fuel tax return. Section 6 removes references to the tax, the cigarette tax stamps from AS 4350-590A. Section 7, 8, and 9 remove references from the exploration incentive credit from AS 4355-11M, 4355-23A, and 4355-23L. Section 10 is the portions of statute that are repealed. AS 06-2030C is the small loan company license. AS 3805-180I is the exploration incentive credit. 419030 is the, once again, it's also a portion of the exploration incentive credit. 4350330B is the excise tax on tobacco products. 435054C is the cigarette tax stamps. And then 435040H is the discount for the stamps. Section 11 provides for transition language relating to the exploration incentive credit. Section 12 is an effective date of January 1, 2016 for the gambling tax activities. Because of the federal calendar year, the fact that gambling tax is paid annually. Section 13 is the effective date of July 1, 2015 for all the other section, so it can comply with the state of Alaska's fiscal calendar year with all other related fees, discounts, and deductions are calculated monthly. Madam Chair, that's the walkthrough of the different sections for the bill, and I'm available for questions as well.
Any questions from committee members? I have a brief question on the, and again, this is not the Finance Committee, but, you know, we get all the material. So it, you are anticipating an impact of $450,000. However, that's not reflected in the fiscal note. And is that, can you explain why we aren't able to show that revenue coming in? And we do actually have three individuals from the Department of Revenue and Ledge Finance here. So if this question is for somebody else,
Madam Chair, I do believe Brandon Spanos is online who has from the Department of Revenue, which can talk more directly about the fiscal note if that's okay.
Mr. Spanos, are you online?
Yes, I'm online.
So my question was just, you know, the difference between the actual fiscal note but the notes on the fiscal note mentioned that there's anticipated revenue to the state, and could you just talk about why that is and then why it is that we can't, you know, say that with any assurance?
So the, I'm just reading that first paragraph of the fiscal note that there's, that one of the measures is indeterminate because
yes.
we don't collect the information on that, and I'm going to have to do some research, or perhaps Dan or McKinsey there in the room could answer that part of the fiscal note. The rest of it, the 450, that is numbers that we can measure. That would be the money foregone for affixing the stamps to the cigarette packs, the other tobacco products amounts, and the motor fuel credit, and the large passenger gaming. Those are numbers that we can quantify, and that's where that $450,000 comes from. The since it doesn't mention the indirect expenditure, or rather the indirect, let me get the name of the credit correct. Exploration incentive credit. That might be the one, although I'm pretty sure that one we've noted hasn't been taken in quite some time.
Okay. Is it McKenzie?
Yeah, for the record, my name is Dan Stickle. I'm Assistant Chief Economist with Department of Revenue. And just to follow up on what our Brandon mentioned, we do have pretty good numbers for several of these exemptions that are being repealed, but for the large passenger vessel gambling tax, the deduction for federal taxes is information that we don't collect currently. So there may be some revenue impact from that, but we don't really... We don't collect that information, so we don't know how much of a benefit we'll get. So the $450,000 is probably the floor. The actual revenue benefit might be higher than that, but it is the lack of information on the gambling tax is the reason we put an indeterminate on the revenue estimate.
And then with this money, this would be money that would go into the general fund, I assume?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, these, I believe, would be general fund.
So the sponsor is shaking his head yes, so that I assume that you know, Representative Thompson.
Madam Chair, I can't say fully that yes, it is, but I believe that was the understanding that these are credits that they take against their corporate taxes and things, so they would be paying more corporate tax to the state, which I assume goes to the general fund.
Okay. And then on the fiscal note, I understand it's to line up the fiscal year that we have. However, it says here that the regulations would go into effect the last day of 2016. And could you explain if the regulations coming online so much later would cause any kind of a problem, or, you know, Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, I have spoken with your staff about the need for a potential CS to readjust the timetable on the effective dates because of when we had the bill first drafted, it was directed towards the passage prior to a fiscal year that's already started, so a CS would... If we could adjust those dates to start the following, you know, 1 year from now, so the 2016 date would be 2017, mm-hmm. The 2016 15 dates would turn into 16.
Okay. Considering the fiscal challenges that we face right now, has there been any discussion about emergency regulations or keeping with this timeline?
Madam Chair, we haven't had that discussion of the impact of retroactive, you know, repeal, and that is a conversation that we can definitely have with the department.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions by committee members? Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the sponsor bringing this bill forward. Hopefully, maybe you can find some more like this, more like $3 billion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Meyer, I would love to see that myself.
All right, good. Well, thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Okay, now I'd like to open public testimony on House Bill 115. Is there anyone here in Juneau or anyone online who would like to provide testimony? Okay. So I'm hearing that there's no one online or here in Juneau to provide testimony on House Bill 115. So with that, I will close public testimony.
115, 155.
Excuse me. Thank you, Senator Ellis. I would like to open public testimony on House Bill 155. Is there anyone online or here in Juneau that would like to testify on House Bill 155? Okay, seeing none, I will then close public testimony on House Bill 155. Thank you, Senator Ellis, for your due diligence in all matters related to following the process. So that could have gotten us into a little bit of a pickle. With that, we will be setting aside this bill to allow members to
review it, and then the sponsor, if there's other issues, like you mentioned, you wanted to perhaps make some changes. So with that, I'm going to take a brief at ease while we wait for the sponsor of the next bill. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order, and next on our agenda is Senate Bill 111. Welcome, Senator Wilkowski. Please feel free to introduce your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Bill Wilkowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage and Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson. I'm joined by Thomas Presley from my office. Thank you for hearing this bill. This is an important bill. I've been working on this issue for 8 years, and here's why. Imagine if the cribs that your baby slept in were full of toxic chemicals. They are. Imagine if the high chairs your kids sat in were full of toxic chemicals. They are. Imagine if the furniture in your homes was full of toxic chemicals. It is. The seats, toys, kids' clothing, all full of toxic chemicals. A toxic cocktail that is in our mattresses, that is in our furniture, not measured by ounces, but rather by pounds in many cases. These chemicals cause neurological deficits. They cause prenatal damage. These chemicals cause hypothyroidism, breast cancer, chemicals that bioaccumulate in animals and fish and are poisoning Alaskans, especially those who live a subsistence lifestyle. Chemicals that are poisoning firefighters who fight fires and breathe in these toxic substances. Do you believe we should take some sort of action to protect Alaskans from these chemicals? Now imagine if we had safer alternatives that are already being widely used. Imagine that some states in the United States have already banned or enacted restrictions against these toxic chemicals. They have. Imagine if the European Union has banned these chemicals. They have. Should we continue to sit back and do nothing? Do we not have an obligation to our constituents and to the people of Alaska to do something? I believe we do. The Alaska Constitution tells us what our obligation is. Article 7, Section 4 says very clearly, quote, the legislature shall provide for the promotion and protection of public health. That is exactly what we're doing with this bill, protecting the public health. I've heard all the industry arguments against this bill over the years. They come from the chemical industry and the phony AstroTurf organizations that they've set up over the years to defeat bills just like this and bills like this all over the country. They've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars just in Alaska and millions of dollars all across the country defeating bills like this. Those are some harsh statements, but I believe they're 100% warranted. Let me tell you just how far these organizations in the chemical industry have gone over the years to defeat bills like this, to defeat this bill, in fact. Many members here will remember some hearings on this bill back in 2010 and 2012. We heard from a Dr. David Heinbeck, who testified three times in front of the legislature. He presented himself as an eminently qualified doctor. In fact, he was the former head of the Harborview Medical Center burn unit in Seattle. He told the tragic story of a six-week-old baby girl whose life he believed would have been saved had flame retardants been used in her crib. He shared pictures of burn victims. Legislators were concerned. The bill passed the Senate, but it was defeated in the House. Several months later, it turned out that nearly all of Dr. Heinbeck's testimony was a lie.
Senator Wilkowski, I'm sorry to interrupt. Is this the same bill as that one that had passed?
Virtually identical, yes. In a six-day front-page spread, the Chicago Tribune dug into the stories and claims of Dr. Heinbeck and found the patients he had testified about across the country were, in fact, non-existent. The Alaska Dispatch News, which was then the Anchorage Daily News, did stories on the fraud Dr. Heinbeck and these organizations committed against the legislature. This one, dated March 19, 2014, Washington physician accused of deception testified three times on Alaska bills. This one, Seattle burn doctor accused of dishonesty and legislative testimony surrenders license. The opponents of this bill will bring up the same old tired complaints and arguments against this bill, that the EPA should regulate it. Since when does Alaska want to turn over authority to the EPA to regulate this? The EPA has had 25 years to do something on this. They've done nothing. That the presence of chemicals in furniture in and of itself is not dangerous. Hundreds of academic and scientific studies say otherwise. We've provided you with copies of numerous studies. We're happy to get you more. The chemical industry will argue that Congress is working on some legislation dealing with this. They've had decades to do this. Nothing. Further, in the legislation that is currently being proposed, states retain the right under the proposed federal legislation to continue to regulate harmful substances in their own states. Please don't buy it this time. They have a vested financial interest in killing this bill. These are dangerous chemicals that have no place in our homes. There are safer alternatives that are just as inexpensive that are available. I'll now turn it over to T.J. Presley from my office to provide more details if there are no questions. Thank you.
We'll go ahead and take members' questions after the staff has continued to present the bill.
So. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on SB 111. For the record, my name is T.J. Presley, staff to Senator Wilkowski. I'd like to just give a quick and brief overview of what SB 111 does, its history, as Senator Wilkowski alluded to, and then talk about the growing amount of literature around the dangers of these polybrominate diphenyl ethers, or PBDEs, to human and animal health. And then I'll quickly wrap up with a quick glance through your packet just to highlight some important notes, because it is a very substantive packet, and we've been working on this bill for many years. So SB 111 is a short bill that does two general things. First, it limits the amount of certain harmful flame retardants that can be in upholstered furniture and in children's items, for sale up to 100 parts per million. Second, it requires manufacturers to label upholstered furniture and children's products that do contain even this small amount of PBDEs in them to alert consumers to their presence. The bill contains civil penalties that begin quite small, and it also places a cap on the total amount of a fine per company in a calendar year as well. The bill also contains definition sections and an exemption for people who may sell the product to another person, for example, selling the couch on Craigslist from one person to another. The bill currently only contains two sections, with the first being contained in Chapter 18 of the Toxic Substances chapter. We've recently been advised by the Department of Labor that the penalties provision is somewhat improperly placed with the Department of Labor. So we have requested a CS that is in process right now that more properly places the penalty section with the Consumer Protection Division within the Department of Law. Currently, the Toxic Substance chapter, Chapter 18, only directs the Department of Labor to inspect schools who have evidence of asbestos. So it's a drafting error that put this civil penalties provision there that more properly belongs with the Department of Law. So that CS is in process. As Senator Wilikowski referenced, many members will remember this bill from the 28th legislature. Dr. Heimbach's very tragic story and pictures that he shared with committee members very much stopped this bill dead in its tracks in 2012. But of course, just a few months later, a very large national outrage came upon finding out that his stories were in fact not true, and Washington State later prosecuted him for fraud, and he surrendered his medical license willingly as a result of that. So the Tribune also, as well as the Anchorage Daily News at the time, went on to establish the connection between Citizens for Fire Safety, who had spent more than $230,000 in this building against this very bill from 2008 to 2012, Dr. Heimbach, and the American Chemical Council, who opposes the bill today. Citizens for Fire Safety is today defunct. The former executive director for that organization and former employee of the American Chemical Council, Grant David Gillum, who we tried to get to testify during this committee, made headlines, actually, for breaking ranks with his organization after learning of their payment to Dr. Heimbach, and eventually ended up testifying in support of a full flame retardant ban in California, which eventually passed in 2014. So PBDEs are dangerous chemicals in the amounts needed to provide substantive help in slowing fires down, according to not only scientists around the world, but also the man whose study is often held up to prove the efficacy of these chemicals, Dr. Vytenis Babrauskas. Another highly eminent scientist who we are trying to get to testify, was the first person in the world to be awarded a PhD in fire protection engineering. His paper in the late 80s has often been distorted since, and as a follow-up, when Dr. Babrauskas found out that his paper was being used in this day, wrote a seminal paper that I've included in your packet as well, but essentially the conclusion states that since 1975, hundreds of millions of kilograms of penta-BDE and its replacements have been used. A fire safety benefit has not been established. Research suggests that this standard should be reevaluated in light of the fire science and health information discussed above. Prior to implementing new flammability standards, decision-makers should evaluate the potential fire safety benefit as well as the health and environmental impacts of these chemicals or the technologies likely to be used. This paper was presented at a conference after Dr. Babrauskas heard of his work being used to defend flame retardants, and he referenced more than 115 sources alone to document the extremely negative health effects of PBDEs. Since 2012, when this bill was gaining lots of traction, the literature around negative effects of PBDEs on human and animal health has grown even larger. I've included just a couple of these in your packet, and we'd be happy to provide you more, but suffice to say, and I'll summarize, that the dangers to human health include risks of neurodevelopmental processes in young children being slowed or changed, passage of the dangerous chemical through the umbilical cord from mother to child, cancer, infertility, attention deficit disorders, among others. These PBDEs enter the body in a variety of ways. And unfortunately, this bill is the start of a process of purging PBDEs and these chemicals from the food supply. More studies have established that PBDEs are in the blood of many fish stocks in the Great Lakes, in Canada, and even some fish in Alaska. Other animal populations who live off these fish, like the bald eagle, are beginning to show evidence of high levels of the chemical in autopsies where large die-offs have occurred. The entrance of the chemical into the food supply is of great concern to Alaska and our rural communities. This bill has drawn great support from these areas because of the threat posed to them by PBDEs. Finally, you'll find many, many, many letters of support in your packet. We have 159 letters from individual Alaskans that have been emailed, categorized by district, that have been shared. We have letters of support from Alaskan firefighters, fire chief organizations, national organizations that have organized to fight cancer, many villages across Alaska, and the Alaska Federation of Natives. The letters of support continue to come in. We're trying to keep up with them so that we may get them to you. But that does conclude my presentation, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, TJ, for that comprehensive presentation. I actually do have a couple questions. My first is just about the short title. It seems to be broader than the what's in the bill, which is my understanding the bill deals with children's items or upholstered furniture.
Correct.
Do you want to just comment on that? Is that intentional?
Madam Chair, it is the intent of the sponsor that the bill be narrowed to upholstered furniture and children's toys, and I can speak to the drafter to ensure that that is reflected in the short title.
Okay, thank you. And then on the labeling section, which is on page 2, line 24, so that if such a product is manufactured, and we're again talking upholstered furniture or a children's item, the person that sells or distributes must label with the following statement, and this is on line 24, this product contains a chemical flame retardant. So two questions. It seems like then they're breaking the law. They're announcing that they're, and that's my first question. My second question is, you mentioned there are other flame retardants. So is it possible that a flame retardant that is not in this list would be used, and then how do you differentiate between the types that you say exist that are not harmful versus those that are harmful and are listed in this bill?
Definitely, Madam Chair. The bill, I've heard it sometimes around the building been called a ban on flame retardants and these things, and actually we did work very hard to make sure that, work with industry of course, and the bill does not ban outright these CBDEs. The bill limits it to a very small amount, to 100 parts per million, or less, that are allowed to be put into these upholstered furniture or children's items. That amount is extremely minuscule, and so the labeling requirement would apply to any company that is still beneath that threshold but does contain the chemical as well. And I do apologize, Madam Chair, was there a second part? Oh, and there, yes, on safer alternatives. So there has been evidence of safer alternatives for flame retardants that are not related to the chemical compound, which we are trying to address in this bill currently. I have reached out to a number of large Fortune 500 even companies, including Ashley Furniture, Walmart, Macy's, Pure One Imports, IKEA. Many of these companies, and there's a large list, have signed a pledge to not to buy office furniture with these flame retardants, but are beginning to produce flame retardant fabrics that don't need to include the flame retardant chemical in them. So I can get some information about which chemicals are they are using, and they are widely available in other states, and I can get that information to the committee.
Is that why the effective date is in July of 2017?
Madam Chair, the effective date is an attempt to give industry some time to absorb the bill, understand the bill, and make a reaction to it.
Okay, and then you had mentioned in your testimony a lot of information about companies, national companies. How will this affect Alaska businesses? I mean, do you have any idea, you know, like today, how many of these items are out there on the shelves? Do you have a sense of that?
Madam Chair, we don't have an exact sense of that, and I can work to get that information for you as soon as possible, and I can work towards that and find out for you.
And then one final question, the list that you provide, so starting on line 10, page 1, going to line 14, page 2, where did that list come from? It's the list of the chemicals.
Yes, Madam Chair. That list came from actually consultation with a number of groups, a number of the scientific groups. Alaska Community Actions on Toxics has been working on this extensively over the past 6 or 7 years, and that list was compiled through a collection of academic studies and recommendations from a number of groups.
Any questions? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. Wouldn't this be better if it's a federal law so that you don't have some states where it's acceptable and other states where it's not acceptable, and has that been pursued?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, or through the Chair, it has been pursued. The EPA has actually been looking at flame retardants for about 25 years and has taken no action on them, which is what prompted many of the states who have taken action because the EPA has done nothing on that. There is a Toxic Controlled Substances Act, which is referenced, that is being worked on right now in the U.S. Senate. And as Senator Willicott referenced, there is a waiver provision in that bill that allows for states to apply for a waiver to these new restrictions and say, if states want to go above and beyond what the basic below federal minimum is, they may apply for a waiver to that provision. Or it also has to do with while the EPA is studying a chemical that allows states to go ahead and take action while they're looking at that chemical. And as we said, of course, the EPA has been looking at flame retardants and PBDEs now for about 25 years. And their last update to their fact sheet was about 2004. So that inaction by the EPA and by the federal government is actually what prompted many states to begin to take action.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I can continue.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, that's a little surprising about the EPA, because usually they're pretty aggressive, at least in Alaska here. So has there been any lawsuits against the, PPDE manufacturers?
Through the chair, that is an excellent question that I do not know off the top of my head, and I can find out for you immediately.
Okay. And then I think you referenced this doctor that was found to not be telling the truth,
right,
in the state of Washington. So what did the state of Washington, have they passed a law similar to this?
Yes, they actually are working on a law similar to this this session, and I need to double-check on whether that law has passed through the chair, but they are currently working on that law. And I do believe that it's passed, and I believe that the ACAT testifiers will back me up and provide some support on that, as they have been tracking that very closely.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Is there anyone online or here in the room from the administration that would like to provide comment on this bill? Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Thank you, PJ. Okay. So with that, I am going to go ahead and open public testimony on Senate Bill 111. There's a few folks who have traveled or who have time constraints, so I'm going to call out for the first couple of testifiers, and then after that I'll open it up to anybody who's here in Juneau or online. First, would like to call Maureen Swanson forward. Maureen, are you online?
Yes, hello. This is Maureen Swanson. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, please continue with your testimony.
Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 111. My name is Maureen Swanson, and I direct the Healthy Children Project for the Learning Disabilities Association of America. LVA is the oldest and largest national volunteer organization advocating for children and adults with learning disabilities. We have chapters and members throughout the country, including in Alaska. We are witnessing an alarming increase in neurodevelopmental disorders that cannot be fully explained by changes in awareness or diagnosis. One in six children in the United States has a reported developmental disability, including autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and other learning and developmental delays. The National Academy of Sciences has stated that environmental factors, including exposure to toxic chemicals in combination with genetics, contribute to at least a quarter of all neurodevelopmental disabilities in the United States. During fetal development and early childhood, the brain is especially at risk from toxic chemicals, even at extremely low exposure levels. Scientific evidence clearly demonstrates that babies and young children are regularly exposed to halogenated flame retardant chemicals, including the flame retardants named in Senate Bill 111. These exposures pose an elevated risk of serious and lasting problems with learning and behavior, including ADHD and autism. These flame retardants cross the placenta to the fetus and are detected in umbilical cord blood and in breast milk. Because of their size and weight, rapid rate of growth and development, metabolism and behaviors, babies and children are likely to experience higher chronic exposures to flame retardants than adults. These chemicals migrate from furniture and children's products into dust and are then ingested by young children. A 2011 study of baby products found that 80% of the items tested contained flame retardant chemicals, while a 2014 study of 40 daycares and preschools found toxic flame retardants in 100% of dust samples at the facilities. What do these constant exposures to toxic flame retardant chemicals mean for the fetus and young children? In the last 5 years, three separate studies of hundreds of pregnant women and children have resulted in strikingly similar findings. Children more highly exposed to PBDE flame retardants prenatally
have lower IQ scores, cognitive delays, and attention problems. The decrements in IQ persist throughout the children's school years. The flame retardant chemicals named in Senate Bill 111 are structurally similar to thyroid hormones, which are essential to healthy brain development. In 2015, scientists with the Endocrine Society concluded that PDDE exposures interfere with thyroid. Recent studies of flame retardants that have replaced PDDE show these chemicals also can disrupt thyroid hormones and pose serious risks to brain development. In plain English, the chemicals named in Senate Bill 111 change babies' brains. I'd like to highlight briefly several specific examples. The chlorinated Tris flame retardant chemicals are notorious. In the late 1970s, TDCPP was one of several Tris flame retardants banned from use in children's pajamas because of grave risks to children's health. Instead of halting production and use of TDCPP, manufacturers instead added this toxic chemical to other children's products and to furniture. A recent study found that TDCPP was the most commonly detected flame retardant in baby products containing polyurethane foam. In 2011, scientists found that TDCPP, as well as other Tris flame retardants, may affect brain development with similar or even greater potency than chemicals already known to be neurotoxic. FireMaster 550 is the second most commonly detected flame retardant in polyurethane foam. It's used in furniture and baby products, including nursing pillows and changing pads. Two of FireMaster 550's main components, TBB and TBPH, are brominated compounds that migrate from products into dust. In 2012, research implicated FireMaster 550 as an endocrine-disrupting chemical with adverse effects at levels much lower than the no observable adverse effect level reported by the manufacturer. The study suggests that FireMaster 550 disrupts thyroid hormone and harms the developing brain. In conclusion, the toxic flame retardants that are named in the Toxic Free Children's Act migrate from furniture and children's products into dust and are ingested by young children. They cross the placenta, build up in the body, and in breast milk. These flame retardants are structurally similar to PCB and also to thyroid hormones. These chemicals put Alaska children at greater risk of learning and developmental disorders, including ADHD and autism. The Learning Disabilities Association of America urges that the Senate pass the Toxic Free Children's Act to protect children's developing minds and bodies from these toxic flame retardants. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Jennifer Gibbons, and I just wanted to mention for those waiting online, we have four individuals who I know want to testify, and there may be others, and we have a little more than 10 minutes left in the committee. Members have other commitments at 3 o'clock. So with that, I'd like to welcome Jennifer, who's here in Juneau. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Jennifer Gibbons with the Toy Industry Association. The Toy Industry Association members were the non-for-profit trade association representing toy manufacturers, retailers, importers, distributors throughout the U.S. We have over 800 members, both large and small in size. While we do share the sponsor's desire to ensure the safety of children, we do have some concerns with this bill as drafted. As was mentioned, I think previously, we would prefer to see the regulation done at the federal level. Product manufacturers are not, having unique state by state requirements is very challenging when they're trying to design and manufacture one product that can be sold in multiple states. And there is an existing network of federal regulations that could address these issues. Children's toys are regulated under the Consumer Product Safety Act, the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, the Federal Hazardous Substances Act, and the Toxic Substances Control Act. Currently, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, under their authority under the Federal Hazardous Substances Act, is evaluating the use of flame retardants in children's products and looking into whether it's warranted to have new restrictions in place. In addition to the challenge with not having a national uniform standard, as it relates to flame retardants in toys. Toy manufacturers do not typically add flame retardants to toys. However, internal components, especially electronic components, electronic circuit boards and other assemblies, may contain trace amounts of flame retardants. While these components would be inaccessible to a child, they are critical to the safety of that product, the electrical safety of the product. The safety of materials, we would hope, would be considered holistically so that we're not having to remove a chemical or use an alternate chemical that then leaves us with a product that is less safe than it was. I appreciate the opportunity to comment here today. This is the first time, I believe, that the Toy Industry Association has provided testimony on this legislation. And with that, I know you have a lot of people to get through, so I will conclude my comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Givens. Next, we have David Levine. David?
Great. Thank you. So thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today, and I'm sorry that I cannot be there in person. The name is David Levine, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of the American Sustainable Business Council, and we're a growing network of business organizations and companies committed to advancing a sustainable economy, and we're representing over 250,000 businesses across sectors and geographies that believe you can grow business, create good jobs, and provide benefits to our communities and protect their health. I'm also representing Companies for Safer Chemicals, which represent thousands of companies committed to advance the safer chemicals and products. And we believe that it's important to pass the Toxic Free Children's Act. You know, every week the new scientific research that's been alluded to, they'll find the increasing incidence and connection between the toxic chemicals and childhood diseases and others. And this uncertainty in the public is eroding consumer confidence and damaging business. More and more companies are motivated to identify safer alternatives to the toxic chemicals, and business leaders concerned about health impacts because it impacts their business. And so they believe that safer chemicals, you know, can be found through both market shifts, but also through smart regulation as well. And without the government regulation that is needed, you know, and needed by Alaska, because it was solved by existing regulations, then we still wouldn't have the problem of so many toxic chemicals in children's products. So we believe it's time to take action on these products through this, and we see incredible market potential. The Pipe research shows that the market for green chemistry and products to grow from $3 billion to $20 billion. In the study that we commissioned, we're seeing double-digit compounded annual growth in a variety of sectors, showing that safer chemicals are proving to be more important to growing the economy than traditional chemicals. Large retailers to small manufacturers are all proving that this can be done, but need guidance because they themselves are having trouble getting the information about the chemicals and being able to apply that to their supply chain. Polling that we did of small business owners show that 73% of small business owners overwhelmingly support reform that would strengthen chemical legislation. So when we hear from businesses that argue against regulations, we're saying that there's a place for regulations along the market work, and that now's the time to have a predictable, consistent set of regulations that will enable business to innovate and to drive the business growth, that will drive the job creation, that will also enable us to find a day when expecting moms no longer have to say, you know, I don't have to hunt for products that fit the needs of protecting my family. I know that these products are safe because government has played a role in this. So when there's a level playing field created by meaningful legislation and creating clarity in the marketplace, that's a great opportunity for business to step forward. So as business leaders, we're saying we can work together with public and private sector, create the economy of tomorrow today, an economy where safer chemicals can be used to create safer products, which spur innovation, create new business opportunities and jobs, and which all parents can rest assured that the only choice is a healthy one. So I know you were time constrained, so I tried to be quick. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Next, I would like to invite Curtis Thayer, and we do have 5 minutes remaining in the committee. So welcome, Mr. Thayer.
Well, thank you very much. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. And our mission is to promote a positive business environment in Alaska, and the Alaska Chamber represents hundreds of businesses and manufacturers across the state since 1952. The Alaska Chamber opposes Senate Bill 111. While we support protecting public health and the environment, there needs to be sound scientific evidence that such risks are in fact present. Given the interdependence of commerce in the United States, it's important that businesses have regulatory certainty across the state. A precautionary approach, while well intended, needlessly threatens the availability of goods and viability of business. Currently, the EPA is conducting assessments of several flame retardants included in this bill. And at a minimum, Alaska should be informed of those scientific assessments before they pass such a bill. The Alaska Chamber supports an update to federal law, and we have supported in the past and continue to support the Chemical Safety Improvement Act that is pending before Congress. And that is my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. Here in Juneau, we have Tim Sheshtick. Please come to the table and provide your testimony. And while you're coming up, I wanted to find out, is there anybody waiting online or here in Juneau interested in testifying on Senate Bill 111? Okay, I guess you have the final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tim Sheshtick. I'm with the American Chemistry Council. I appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments today. I won't reiterate the comments made by Ms. Gibbons and the Alaska Chamber. We certainly support the attempt to develop a uniform system in terms of a regulatory landscape. There is activity happening at US EPA, as Mr. Thayer alluded to. The US EPA is conducting assessments of all of the flame retardants that are included in Senate Bill 111, as well as other flame retardants. So I would encourage the committee to at least be informed by that information before moving to restrict any sort of chemical compound under this legislation. I would point out that this debate isn't about whether there are organizations or groups that support safe chemicals and those that do not support safe chemicals. Our companies have a responsibility to produce safe products. We certainly understand that. We're a part of the effort to ensure that the products we made for their intended use are safe for consumers. And that's why we're providing as much information as we possibly can to US EPA so they can conduct those assessments appropriately and based on all of the available information. In the interest of time, we have submitted a detailed letter that touches on not only some of the science issues that we feel have been identified as problematic in this bill. Assessing chemicals is a complex undertaking. You cannot basically say that there are chemicals that are either safe or unsafe, toxic or non-toxic. You have to look at how those chemicals are used. We use a number of chemicals that would be very dangerous at high doses. We use them on a daily basis for safe drinking water. So there are a number of examples that you have to look at in terms of assessing overall chemical safety. So with that, again, I would encourage you to take a look at our written comments. We would be available to provide any additional information if the committee does have any questions about our comments. With that, we do oppose this bill as it's drafted. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And it appears that we do have several individuals waiting online, so I'm going to leave public testimony open on Senate Bill 111. And with that, we will see members next week on Tuesday. I want to thank everyone who brought their bills before the committee today. It's been a very, very interesting array of legislation. With that, we're adjourned.